Hello and welcome. It is December 29th, 2016 for about half of us. And I am James Jones, and this is the very last Radio Free Nintendo of 2016. This may be a numbered episode. I haven't decided yet.
Okay.
If it is, this is 503. And if it's not, this is whatever stupid name I gave it. I'm joined today by Mr. Greg Leahy.
Hoi hoi, everyone.
And in terms of RFN cast members, that's it. Because Guillaume and John are off having a spiritual experience together. And so today I am joined by, I'm 100% confident this is a mistake, Mr. Don Koopman.
Yes, the European editor of Nintendo World Report is here, baby.
And Mr. N. McNulty.
I'm stopping my Game of the Year work for one night. Just for you.
For one night. So this is an interesting cast I have assembled, to say the least. So buckle up. This could get this could turn into a ride. Our goal for this episode, because the holidays are still ongoing and recording is still tough and editing is still tough, is we're really going to keep this to a one segment. We're going to do a little new business for our guests here, and then we're going to transition to a couple emails. Obviously, with, as what we're referring to internally, as Switch Miss coming up, we're going to have some interesting episodes coming up in the next few weeks. We're going to have some plans for those announced soonish, hopefully sooner than it actually happening. We just have to decide internally what we're going to do with it. So we've probably got one episode in us before then and now, but for now, we're just wanting to give you something to listen to during the break. And if this turns into some weird experience where you feel like you've been drinking and you haven't been, I'm sorry. But Don.
Yes.
You've been playing some video games from Japan.
Indeed, I've been playing a lot of video games from Japan because there's nothing more coming out in Europe or North America, apparently.
Never again.
What have you been playing, Don?
I've been mostly been playing, and I'm actually going to write an NWR review on this, Miitopia.
So, Don, to quote the ongoing conversations about Miitopia from a few months ago, what the f*** is Miitopia?
Miitopia is a, wow, it is a RPG, but it's not. It's really not. It's a simulation of what an RPG could look like.
It's hold a on, bunch hold of on. Sketches dressed up as an RPG, right?
It's a video game simulator is what you're telling
it's
me.
It's a RPG simulator. So let me break this
coming
down
to
for
Steam
you.
Steam Greenlight.
Wow, okay. I didn't see that one coming, but fair. So, I would say, first of all, that I like the story and like the world of Miitopia a lot. And that's what kind of reeled me in the first place. Because you choose your Mii, you can make one there in the game itself, or choose one that you already have on your 3DS, or use a QR code to actually promote like that you can also use your Miitomo QR codes or whatever you want with it. So I just put my Mii in, make it the star of the show. I was like, whatever, let's do this. And basically you're just adding a whole bunch of a cast of Mii characters to that world and populate it with the faces that you know and love.
Or hate.
That's very well possible. Actually, you need to also, give your main villain the face, which is the great demon king, I think. And I decided that it would be Mario.
Okay.
Yeah, fuck him.
That's not Nintendo sanctioned in the slightest.
Absolutely not. So the great Demon King, now Mario in my game, decided to steal all of the faces of all the characters in the world and plaster them across enemies in the game.
He could have just eaten a cake.
He could have, yeah. So instead of like traversing a world, you traverse levels, very linear levels, where you can't walk. You automatically go from place to place, see a little scene, or go into battle. And there you can give your personal character, so the main star of the show, like an attack, and sadly the rest of them will be done automatically in your party. There is very little interaction in this thing. So outside of a few clicks or choosing an attack for your own character, you do actually very little while playing the actual video game, which I think is the main problem with it. in general.
It's like a visual novel. You just progress the text, right?
Yeah, and I think that the characters and how they present themselves is super charming. They have done a lot of good work with that, and I think the presentation is really sharp. But where it really falls short for me is just the interaction aspect. Like, the battles don't really feel that engaging, and there's even an option to just do it all automatically. So I was just holding the B button and let the battles be done for me. Which is not necessarily a good thing for a video game, but there you go. And then traversing for the levels is also done automatically. There's a bit more interaction with, like, switches you need to pull or little scenes that you need to interact with. But there's not much in the way in that sense either. I think the main draw is, like, having those interactions with those characters, moving the story along, and just going through these levels as quickly as you possibly can. There's a lot of gear for your characters. There's ways to upgrade it, so at least they give it some more of an RPG background than I thought they would. But it's, in general, it's still sort of a disappointment, because I was sort of hoping that I would lean more into it, honestly. And while I do think that they do a lot of cool stuff with, like, the chats and the simulation aspect of it, as a game, it falls sort of on its face.
So, I'm going to play stupid here and pretend I don't know this. This sounds okay for a $5 or $10 game. Is that what this is?
No, it's a full retail game.
Yeah.
And also, it's, you would expect, like, okay, I can deal with some of these problems if it's, like, maybe 10 to 12 hours long. No, this game is 35 hours long.
Why?
So here's another infuriating aspect.
What do you
aspect.
Do for 35 hours?
Okay, so
hit
James,
the A button.
James, no, really, let me break this down. So you do the stuff that I just mentioned, but in the first three areas, after you finish one area, they take all your party members away, all of your skills and everything on your character, and you will have to start from level one again on all of your new characters.
True.
And they do that for three times, and after that it goes into sort of like the latter half of the game, where all the characters come together and you have one final big adventure.
This isn't an RPG. This is,
yeah.
This is more of an adventure.
So all right, let me ask the, well, Don's going to struggle with this, I suppose. But
okay,
is it an entertaining adventure?
No.
I like the scenes of it a lot, and again, the interaction is really cool. But it's, for me, it needs to be more of a video game to keep entertaining for all of those hours, and it really isn't. There's a spark that just I want to keep going because, like, the characters are so fun, but it's, with too little gameplay in it, it's just a struggle to keep it up.
Here is one of my descriptions for the game, and I think I said this to Don when he was playing. For me, it's like if you take some of the scenes and interactions in Tomodachi Life, add an RPG skin to it, and subtract a lot of the randomness.
I feel there's still a lot of randomness in Miitopia.
It's not in the same conversation as Tomodachi Life.
No, but I think it's well-placed in the context of what this thing is.
Can you explain that statement?
Sure, I can. So, the relationships that you build, characters get jealous, characters get in love with each other, they find each other very friendly. In battle, they will block each other attacks, and that will increase their relationship. If they get annoyed with one another, they will get in each other's way. So there is a risk and a reward to building those relationships, like, early in your game.
I see. So really, the actual building of the relationships is the only part for you that sounds like you have real agency. Like,
yeah.
Well, you have any agency.
Yes.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
let me rephrase that statement.
The relationship can alter without agency, but you can build them with agency.
Okay, have some agency.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like that's where you have the best opportunity to influence the final outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So some of the relationships I've built are way into level 40s. So they will always help each other. They will do some ridiculous damage when they are working together. So you can really guide that. And that's the only thing you have some real guidance over.
Hmm. So, and then that actually influences the outcome of these story segments that you play through, I suppose.
Yeah. But you can also get some gear now and again to upgrade your characters and make that aspect a little more. You can give them food to increase their stats. But only when you are in the inn, when you do all of this stuff, that's when you have actually the most interaction of the entirety of the game.
The thing I'm reminded of is Miyamoto made a comment when he was discussing why it is that Bowser keeps kidnapping Princess Peach. He said he views them as like a traveling performance troupe telling the same story over and over again. It sounds like somebody at Nintendo made that a game.
Yes, they did.
So this is basically cast a play and watch it happen with some agency over.
You're in the movies.
Yeah, it is. Except movies, there was no real, like, the outcome of the movie could be bad. It was whatever your script was. So I when I was in Japan, like, this game was getting pushed hard.
They did, yeah.
I mean, like, pretty much every train station had a Pokemon ad, Pokemon Sun and Moon. But a lot of the big ones, and even some of the smaller ones, had, if you've seen the Miitopia Nintendo Direct, it's this sharply dressed guy in a suit. He's kind of Japanese handsome, you know, the stereotypical, like, this is what Japanese models look like, standing in a library speaking in hushed tones like this about Miitopia, and occasionally he's looking at a book or something.
It was lots of
pictures of him standing in a library with the word Miitopia and a release date.
Yep.
And that was the advertising campaign for this thing. And it was everywhere. If you went in electronic shops, there'd be Miitopia stands that were just him in front of, like, shelves for the game. And I see why now, because what the hell would you put on the ads for this game?
I mean, you could put the focus on a lot of the enemies in that game, because the enemies are also really goofy and funny. Like, their noses and their penguins with, like, a Mii's face on it. It's actually sort of disturbing sometimes, but it's also super funny and hilarious. But it's the fun aspect comes from the humor in the game, not so much from the gameplay. And I think it needed that to succeed, and that's where it really falls flat.
The gameplay rings similarly in terms of depth with, like, Find Me.
I disagree and agree with that. I think that you can guide it more than Find Me, but at the end of the day, yeah.
It's
Find Me with a story mode.
Yes, the actual depth. Find Me, but you're not relying on the Street Past characters.
Mm. So let me ask a question, and you can both answer this because you both played it. There's no way this is a full-price retail game in North America or Europe. It's not happening.
If it ever comes out in Europe or America, please don't. Like, really?
Look at the shit they release here at full price. Of course it's a full-price game. Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not, because there's no way.
NCL makes that call.
Because we'll know what this is.
NCL makes that call.
There's no way it'd be a retail game.
This game was very successful in Japan at that price.
We don't even... Yeah, but Japan's weird. We don't even get normal games as full retail releases in North America.
I would see it... Like, if it ever comes to Europe, right? I would see it in a scenario similar to how they handled Nintendo Pocket Football Club.
Okay, how did they handle Nintendo Pocket Football Club? We never even got that game.
It was a full retail game in Japan, but they actually made it like a €15 download.
Okay.
Like Inazuma 11 in the West.
Yeah, I think you could, like, couldn't you? Okay. Wasn't it one of those, like, code in
get a code in a box, but it's ultimately... I think that they handled that really well. It was also way sharper than the Japanese version, but it was also for a really good price. I think 15 is a perfect price for it, and if they released Miitopia, I would at least see some sales from it.
James, can we go back to the fact that you said that we don't even get normal games at retail, and I think you're referring to Rhythm Heaven as a normal game?
Well, there's Rhythm Heaven. There is
Picross 3D.
That is a normal game. Rhythm Heaven is not a normal
in
game.
Europe,
Fatal Frame,
we didn't get retail.
Yeah, in Europe, both those games became a retail game.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah, that's right. They came later, but they were at retail, and Fatal Frame had a limited edition kind of release.
I just refuse to accept you calling Rhythm Heaven normal.
It's more normal than this.
It's better than normal.
Oh, right. It is better than normal.
It's super normal. It's better. It's more normal than Miitopia.
Yeah, sure.
Like, when I say normal, I mean it has a gameplay loop.
Okay, yes.
Like, it is a in the traditional definition of the word game, it fits. Let's say
it that
way.
If we're going to talk about traditional definitions of games, you need to look at my Game of the Year list.
Oh, fuck. all right, Don, Puyo Puyo, give me something that isn't what's coming, and I'm worried.
Oh, so you want something that's not coming? Okay.
well, to be fair.
So, Puyo Puyo Chronicle, it's the latest entry in the long-running Puyo Puyo franchise, which is a puzzle game franchise, if you don't know. But this one is an RPG, and I actually really enjoy it. It brings, like, all of the characters from the various Puyo Puyo games together in one universe, and you create a party with them. Each have their own special attacks, which you move during the actual Puyo Puyo gameplay when you're fighting enemies. And basically how it works is that you just build up combos, and that's how you do damage against your opponents. And you run around, you talk to NPCs, and solve quests. It's an actual RPG of Puyo Puyo.
Here's a question, Don.
Sure, go ahead.
You've played Pazudora Cross, right? Cross.
No, I have it downloaded. I barely played it.
Okay, because I was going to ask which you thought translated to an RPG framework better, but...
Yeah, I'm. So you didn't play what was the one that came
Z
dual packed with Mario?
I did Z. Play Z.
Z is very different than Cross.
Oh, okay.
I did absolutely play Z.
Cross is way better. Z is an RPG framework around Pazudora, Puzzle and Dragon. If people don't know, and Cross is an RPG that happens to have Pazudora as the combat system.
I think it's similar. I think if you say it like that, I think Puyo Puyo Chronicle is very similar in that sense.
Okay.
Because it has the traditional enemy tropes, and you level up characters, you build up strong teams. But the big difference is that Puyo Puyo is your combat system.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say characters, the only character I could think of is Arl. Are there actually other Puyo characters? Because all I could think of is going, ice, fire.
there are actually other Puyo characters. Especially if you look at the various games, they had different set of characters. In the last couple of games, they brought them all together, especially with Puyo Puyo Tetris and stuff. But you start as Arla, which is, I think, good. I mean, it's the character that most people would know if you know Puyo Puyo. But it goes deeper in the lore as you go along, and it's actually.
The lore. Are there novelizations? Of course there's novelizations. Are there officially sanctioned novelizations?
I just saw a manga, so...
How does
Mean Bean Machine and Kirby fit into the Puyo Puyo lore?
They don't fit into Puyo Puyo lore.
I think her pet is in Mean Bean Machine.
That machine was really mean.
God, I mean, maybe it's an average. It's an average bean machine. Thank you.
Yeah,
it's just misunderstood.
The last number of Puyo Puyo games all had a story mode, so there is actual lore there, despite
except
what
for
want.
Tetris.
But it's more fleshed out in a way that feels more natural because you're actually like interacting with a whole bunch of characters, NPCs, like you would in an RPG, and. Most of them give you a quest to toy around with. You have to find some item, you have to do some certain stuff. You give you extra rewards if you do it in a certain way during battle. There's a whole bunch of variables there that are really fun. And next to the RPG, like, which I put, I think, around 22 hours into.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They're the basic, like, Puyo Puyo modes with different rule sets. So I think about 18 different rule sets in Puyo Puyo in there, which is pretty impressive.
That's a lot of rules for... So Puyo is match 4? I'm trying to remember now.
No, match 3.
Match 4 or larger, yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, 4.
It's 4 or larger, yeah. Yes.
I'm thinking of a variant.
Sorry. I'm trying to think what all the rule sets would be. I do know, you're right, there are other characters. I remember the bad guy in Puyo, I think his name's Satan.
Yeah.
Which just...
Samuel Hayden?
Just shut it all down. Just shut everything down.
I think you meet him also, like, really early on.
Well, he's the main bad guy. I mean, he's Satan. Like, he's going to be wherever he wants.
Actually, he joins your team, I think. He joins your team.
Yes, he's not called Satan in the North American releases because that would be evil.
Yeah.
But yeah, it... The idea of making Puyo story modes is bizarre to me, but to hear they've been doing it for a while at some point is just like, well, yeah, I mean, sure, why wouldn't they be doing that?
Yeah, but the different rule sets, like, for example, they have an aspect called Fever, where everything is already straight up and you need to just drop down the right Puyo to make a huge amount of combos. That's, for example, a rule where you just have to keep doing it and building up garbage for the other opponent, like, in a very heavy way. And that's one of my absolute favorites.
So this just came out, too. Like, it came out very recently.
Sega America is currently soliciting requests for this game via Twitter.
Soliciting requests? What does that even mean?
It means that they want to know if you're interested in this game being localized.
Here's the interesting part for me, though. I talked about both of these games. They both came out on the same day, and
one
it's
of
a
them
stark
is way better.
It's a stark contrast of how different both of those games are.
One of them is an RPG. The other was billed as an RPG.
Yep.
Yeah, that's video games. We just talked about video games. Saren, are you going to talk about video games?
Sure, I've got 10 of them.
That's not a strong start to that statement.
Sure. So, I have been knee-deep all week in Game of the Year stuff, creating categories, creating nominations. I still don't even know who wins any category, except I've made my own personal top 10 best Game of the Year list. So I was thinking I would just quickly read it out and say one or two things that might be interesting to the listeners of this show about each one, and that can sort of be my new business is.
Okay.
So I'll go 10 to 1. Everyone knows my number 1. But my number 10 is Inside, which is not out on a Nintendo platform. That's PC, PS4, Xbox One. It's the successor to Limbo. It's about 3.5 hours, best played in one sitting, and it's probably the darkest, most depressing thing I've played all year.
Great.
Hmm.
I mean, so when she says it's a successor to Limbo, this is a Playdead game.
Yes, this is a Playdead game. It's about 2 to 4 hours, and it took 6 years to make. It is every single frame is seemingly perfectly crafted. Like, every single thing is there for a purpose. Everything is very deliberately paced. There are plenty of mechanics you see once and then never again because the game is done with them and it's not afraid to reuse assets or it doesn't feel like it has to reuse assets, rather, or reuse ideas. It's just this really strong, depressing tale that is very worth seeing if you have hardware, and it's frequently on sale these days, but also it's very worth the asking price of $20.
It's a puzzle platformer, right?
Sure.
Actually, the actual gameplay cycle. I mean, that's the actual gameplay cycle. It's really about, like, you go through stages and you have the ability to manipulate the manipulate the stage to clear the air.
You can pull boxes, you can jump on the boxes, you can climb ropes and swing, and you can navigate. But the core goal of the game is to find out what's going on.
Right. It's a story-focused experience.
Yes, 100%, and there's not a single word of dialogue.
It's mostly silent, isn't it?
Yes, there's ambient noise. There's one room, and it's not like the room of the climax, but it's built into the climax. There's one specific room where they completely cut out 100% of the audio. It's haunting. So my number 9, which I thought was going to be way higher until I started ordering the list and saying, does this game go above this game? My number 9 is Final Fantasy 15. I love that game a whole lot. I talked about it on the Devil's Third stream that they're going to be talking about in a minute.
That's it.
Her number 1 game.
No, yeah, that's my number 1 game of 2016. Of course it is. No. Just something that might be of interest to listeners is my opinion on the back half, the controversial back half of that game. I really liked it the whole way through. I thought I liked it a lot more than I did until I started ordering my list and realizing that 8 other games resonated with me more than it. But I really, really like it. I stand by my review. I stand by that game.
Seren, that's it.
Oh, yes. I've discovered a new recipe.
Oh, God.
That awful bullshit.
I was just impressed by the Stand By Me reference.
Oh, that goddamn... That's my other favorite thing about that game is Ignis. You will go and you will order, like, french fries at a restaurant. He will eat the french fries and then he will loudly proclaim, I've discovered a new recipe! Right to the face of the person who sold him that food. And he does that the entire game. Anytime he eats something.
Yeah.
He orders any food and he just immediately shouts, I've discovered a new recipe!
I say something honest regarding Final Fantasy games? I think I enjoyed World of Final Fantasy more than Final Fantasy 15.
The English localization of World of Final Fantasy could have used some goddamn work.
Yeah, I played it in Japanese.
The localization could the use the more the localization the time.
Yeah. I played it for the game in Japanese, to be honest, so...
That's a better... language track. My number 8, which I've spoken about extensively on this podcast, as is James, is Phoenix Wright Ace Attorney Spirit of Justice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I super stand by that game. Played through it in Japanese. I recently picked up the English version when it was on sale for $20 and replayed the whole thing. Still stand by that thing. The English localization is more pun-heavy than the Japanese version was, or at least more... The puns are more shallow. The Japanese puns are all based on, like, history and, like, religious lore. And then the English ones are, like, peace, love, and understanding.
Yeah.
Right.
They're offensive.
I'll be your guy.
Extreme, extreme, extraordinary ways they are offensive. Like this is a series trope, but at this point the localization team has basically just like that they've bought their own product at this point. They're like, oh yeah, it went from being like kind of like look how dumb we're being to be like, no, we're really funny, good comedians. This is gonna be our thing. And it's like, no, these are terrible. They've always been terrible. Stop.
I will say, if you type peace, love, and understanding into your Google search bar on Chrome, the first autocomplete is, what is the pun?
Yeah, well, that's fair.
So it's not obvious enough for some people.
The worst part is that they had this made-up language to play with, so they basically just did whatever the F they wanted now. It's just like, well, yeah, his name could be 75 syllables long. It became No Rules, No Limits, like... pun names, and you would just sit there and go like, all right, his name is 87 characters long. What are they trying to say to me right now?
Just read it out loud.
You sound it out and go, fuck this game.
I will say this game is more on here based on my time with the Japanese, which is less pun intensive. It might FF15 might have beat it if I played it in English first.
Like I want to say that. You are saying this is a game that's less pun intensive in Japanese, a people who think puns are the highest form of comedy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. God damn it.
Yeah, though the English version is insanely pun heavy. Daigakuten Saiban, not very pun heavy, it turns out.
Oh, we'll never get that game.
You'll never
make
a
pun out of the name. All right, next game up.
It's number 7, Hitman: The Full Experience.
Okay.
We'll come back to that one.
We will be back there in a minute.
Number 6, because my outlet is classifying this as one large title for Game of the Year qualification purposes, Fire Emblem Fates. This encompasses the entirety of my experience with it, playing through each campaign twice last year in Japanese, playing through each campaign once in English, and then going back in and hacking an even harder difficulty in, adding all these extra marriage options. I've just found myself with this game month after month after month.
I mean, Conquest at some points is basically fucked in hardest difficulty.
Oh,
like,
make it harder.
Why would you go, like, let's go make this worse?
Because, boy, is it satisfying when you double the difficulty and you still manage to scrape by.
Like, because there are stages in, like, the last 5 of Conquest where the game basically goes, hey, what? Fuck you.
Yeah.
Yep. That's Conquest's box code in a nutshell.
My rule with that was put on Phoenix, but make it so challenging that the challenge is it even possible for every single party member to survive every turn?
Okay. Yeah, see, Phoenix might make Conquest passable at that difficulty, but, like, there's stuff where
Phoenix,
it's just, like,
but you die in one hit.
Classic Conquest, like, the last 3 stages must have caused people to drink.
Yeah, no, it's Phoenix with some of your punishment system where you put someone out of rotation.
Yeah, it's brutal.
As somebody who played a lot of Fire Emblem games, and I played all of them, also the Japanese ones, Conquest was a challenge the first time I played it. Sure.
Oh, I loved it.
There's some real shit in that game.
I would have done that first if the lesbian had been in that one, but the lesbian was in Birthright, so I went through that one first.
I can imagine.
Yep. Oh, you don't even know. Sure. We've got multiple games in my top 5 for that.
Oh, we do know. All right, continue.
Number 5, Tokyo Mirage Sessions, Sharp FE.
Yes.
All my raving about that, it did get in the top 5. It's the bottom of the top 5. That game is really special.
It's an Atlas game.
That is my game of the year.
That game is really, really, truly... Oh, well, then imagine my top 4. That game is really, truly something special. It's no secret that I dislike the Wii U as playing... I dislike the gamepad specifically, rather. The system's fine. But, like, I try and play on the Pro Controller where I can. And... even though that game doesn't support the Pro Controller, when I was compiling my Best of Wii U nominees list, Best Wii U exclusive, rather, for Game of the Year, I forgot that game because I didn't associate it with my dislike of the gamepad. That is saying something really backhanded to that game.
Yeah, it is. Number 4?
Number 4. Christine loves Lady Killer in a Bind, which I didn't get to talk about on this podcast, and I won't talk about at length. Know that it's 18 plus, but there is a safe for work mode where you can cover everything up with Christmas sweaters.
God damn.
So
it doesn't change what the game is about,
it doesn't change what the game is about.
This is a game about consenting adults in adult situations.
So is this game?
Okay, so So the elevator pitch is that there's a high school graduation, basically a school non-sanctioned boat cruise ship getaway for this for these very, very rich high school students. And your character, the Beast, has a twin brother who everyone hates, but is too busy doing Machiavellian shit. You are replacing him. You're his twin sister, and there are 3 people on this boat that know your true identity and no one else. And it's about balancing relationships, and I will say one of the best things about this game, and it's very, very safe for work, this what I'm about to say, is you get a lot of there are many ways to play this game, because there's a social game where you're trying to get votes, and the person who gets the most votes get by the end of the week gets millions of dollars. You can try and play for romance. You can try and play to blend in, but you could also just try and have fun. All the conversation choices have deadlines for where in the conversation you can say this thing and it still makes sense. So, like, dialogue choices will pop up on screen, but you can just keep listening and you can choose later when to say it. They'll fade away. They'll come in. It tells you what they're going to do. And it's this mechanic in a visual novel I haven't ever experienced that revitalized that gameplay for me in a big way. It's just some really, really funny writing. One of my nominees for best moment of the year is developing an actual emotional connection with all of the characters in this game, even the ones you hate. Like, this game's writing does really, really grabs you and pulls you in. Too hot for Steam, but still very, very good.
Okay.
My number
three.
My number three is Shin Megami Tensei 4 Apocalypse.
You are atlasing up this thing.
We're not done.
I'm sure.
Yeah, there are three Atlas games on my top 10. So
your top five.
Yeah, three in my top five as well. So a while ago, back in like March. Back in March, I was on RFN talking about this alongside Tokyo Mirage Sessions, and I defined the differences as Tokyo Mirage Sessions is in the gateway style of SMT, and and Apocalypse, then called Final, is more in the you're already here, you're here for the real shit. And debating which one of these two games came out on top of my Game of the Year list was really just deciding which I found more satisfying at the time. And that really boiled down to Apocalypse. I really enjoyed getting a full hardcore, put it up on expert, just all the enemies are 30 levels higher than you, just outwit the whole game, just outsmart the battle system, master everything, fuse until your fingers fall off, working with spreadsheets and just jotting down notes about how you're going to fuse and breed so that you get the Megami breed with Dear Rahan. And just, anyways, that game pulled me in between the three playthroughs, one Japanese, two English. I easily put over 200 hours into that game this year. That game is really something special. And that final boss in the lawful route is fucking hilarious. You get to punch a certain deity in the face. And anyways, they have some fun. Number two, Kindred Spirits on the Roof, which I'm infamous for on this show.
You've also infamous might be a strong word, but you've definitely talked about it on this show.
All I'll say really is this game was not too hot for Steam, so you can go find it.
Okay.
Yep.
That game also there are
adult situations in that game.
Oh, that's not what I was going to say.
Okay.
There are two games. My number one and my number two are the only two games this year to make me cry, not out of misery. I did some crying like an anime fan on prom night with some other games. But
oh, God. All right.
This isn't that list. Kindred Spirits made me cry, as well as my number one, Persona 5. Should be obvious if you think that doesn't qualify because that didn't come out in North America in 2016, replace it with Style Savvy Fashion Forward, because there was a rad NPC who told me that she wanted a full makeover to look like a tube of toothpaste.
Don't we all?
And I did it for her, and she said, thanks, I've never felt fresher, and she walked away. So...
But yeah,
shut it down.
It's interesting, because for me, again, my number one is Tokyo Mirage Sessions. I think I've never put a Atlas game at my number one spot.
You haven't been living.
Yeah, I know.
Nah, if you follow Atlas RPGs fervently, you'll know I'm right there with you. No, Persona 5, I mean, what can I say? The visuals, fantastic. The soundtrack I listen to every day still. The characters are very, very intelligent and deep and more emotionally intelligent than P3, P4. Mm-hmm.
It's a labor of an extended amount of development time, and it shows.
Yes, and then we're going to get Persona 6 announced in 2017, as well as theoretically SMT5. So 2017, also going to be a great year.
So, that's your top 10 list. I want to talk a little bit, because we're actually pushing on time more than I expected to.
Mm-hmm. Finally, we're going to talk about Devil's Third.
Hell yeah, we are.
In a minute. I wanted to talk really briefly about the fact that I walked away with, and I'm not, I did the math, about $1,000 worth of video games.
Okay.
For about $200.
Yep.
And even something like games as a service, Hitman, I basically bought for half price.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the question.
Fair, that's not really games as a service. That's more episodic. Games as a service is more like Dota.
I mean, yeah, to an extent. I mean, is Dota games as a service, though? Dota's more free to play.
Sorry, I meant like over, like, yes, I said Dota. I meant like Overwatch, where you pay $60 and then you stick with it for months and months and months and months and months.
Yeah, so the thing is, this isn't sustainable, right?
Nope.
The fact that AAA games are now $45, I'm regularly seeing Final Fantasy 15 for $15+ off.
I mean, yeah, I'm seeing FF15 for $35, I'm seeing Titanfall for $25.
Is there a reason for this? Is it just sales, or is it retailers panicking?
So, I just want to read four stats before I move in. Just talking about the health of the industry, these are from the NPD sales results for November 2016. Mm-hmm. Retail game sales are down 24% year over year. Hardware
from
was down. Yes, over last year. Hardware, which we got two new PS4s and a new Xbox One, as well as three VR headsets this year. Hardware was down 35% year over year.
Do they count the VR sets as hardware?
They do.
Okay.
Console and handheld game sales were down 18% year over year, including digital. Physical and Steam PC software sales were down 28%.
Oof. And last year, I'm trying to remember, last year was the year that people complained that everything got delayed to this year, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, what the hell was selling last year? Like, this is an important question.
I can't even joke about that.
Alright.
I mean, here is November's top 10 games.
Okay.
I will note, if you count Sun and Moon as one SKU, which the NPD does not, that is the number one selling game. Number one, Call of Duty Infinite Warfare. Number two, Battlefield 1. Number three, Pokemon Sun. Number four, Pokemon Moon. Those also exclude eShop. Number five, Titanfall 2. By the way, the gulf between Moon and Titanfall 2 is Titanfall 2 ain't getting a sequel.
Yeah.
Six, NBA 2K17. Seven.
Which came out a long time ago.
Seven. Madden NFL 17.
Which came out an even longer time ago.
Eight. Watch Dogs 2, which tanked.
Yeah.
Nine. The Elder Scrolls 5 Skyrim.
Oh my god.
And number 10, FIFA 17. November 2016, that was the top 10.
Yeah, so without really getting too deep into this, like, The console sales being down, I get to some degree, the hardware sales.
Mm.
But I mean, where the Xbox was last year and where it is this year is night and day. The Xbox One S was, I mean, from where it was, a relatively successful launch.
Yes, and it stayed successful until PS4 Pro, and PS4 Pro revitalized PS4, and with revitalized PS4, hardware down 35% year over year.
But what I don't get is the software, because in theory, the install bases are better. But the only thing I could think of is that people who were still playing on previous gen consoles stopped buying games. And that previously there were still games being downported to those systems. And now that those are gone, with the exception of your Maddens and your NBA 2Ks, that it's having a downward pressure effect on sales.
Minecraft isn't on the top 10.
It isn't, which is kind of amazing. But you remember, like, Destiny still came out on the 360 and PS3.
They stopped compatibility this year.
They did. They did. But that's what I'm saying. Yes. So I'm wondering if maybe that is the net effect here, because the current gen consoles obviously have a much higher install base.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering if
paying customers.
Yeah, the termination of support of those older legacy systems is what ultimately has led to the downfall, because
I don't know.
That's the only way you could say that there's less game systems in the marketplace, is if you say, well, these two are effectively dead now.
See, I don't really know, because the other thing is AAA sales are down even more than they have been, and that industry was already feeling like it was toppling. But then you also have the fact that 40% of Steam's games came out in 2016.
Yeah.
And yes. Indie...
That's haunting.
It is. So the AAA space is more dangerous than ever right now. You'll notice Gears of War 4, 1 month old, not on this list.
Yeah.
But then you look at indie games, and there are games that come out on Steam that sell zero copies. There are games that come out on console that sell under a dozen copies in its lifespan.
Ooh.
It's at the point now where... So I've released two games, one Wii U, one 3DS, full disclosure, they talked... James and RF and crew talked about it, whatever. They gave disclaimers at the time. So I released those being satisfied that they were where I wanted them to be. And they reviewed both of them reviewed all over the place, but they sold where I thought they would. And now I'm looking at Monochrona, and I've put 2.5 years into Monochrona. And Monochrona's coming out on just about every platform. I've announced it's coming out for Nintendo Switch. And the thing about Monochrono at this point is I'm not comfortable releasing this thing until I think, and I really loathe this term, and I really loathe the thing like a AAA, if the Metascore is not going to be visible on the front page, I don't think it's worth putting out at this point.
Mm.
Because there are so many games coming out every single week, and there's a reason why Don has to start his e-shopping feature, because Kutar is making everything invisible.
Here's 36 Kutar games that came out today.
ten amazing Kutar games that I played. Yeah.
No.
So actually, this is something that I think all of us can sort of speak to a little bit. Mm-hmm. Saran, and I'm sure you've had conversations with other people who are making games.
Absolutely.
How do you make sure your game gets any eyeballs from and I hate using this word, opinion leaders or whatever dumb bullshit think piece is emailing us today?
Games with Gold PS Plus.
Influencers.
Yeah, influencers. Yeah.
Games with Gold PS Plus.
Isn't that the word of the day?
Is that it? Is that really the approach? Like, you need to get into
a first party needs to send out an email.
And that's hard. Like,
also out this week on the eShop, you're dead in the water. If you're not, good luck. Like, even if you get top slot promotion for a third party game on a Nintendo system, good luck. You're not doomed. But on, like, I could just pull up the PlayStation Store right now and the PlayStation blog and name the games that came out last week and ask you how many of them you've actually ever heard of.
And the answer would probably be zero.
It would probably be, it would probably be like, I've heard of this one VR game that just came to PSVR and then nothing else. Also, I have a PSVR game in the can that... I don't even know. I was banking that first half of 2017 there might actually be enough headsets out by then.
I have seen them in stores now, which leads me to think I don't know where that is going right now. John, if John were here, John would be going, I told you VR is doomed.
I mean,
but it's a hard ask of consumers to say, hey, go buy this thing that's a lot of extra money to play the system you already paid a lot of money for. Also, if you really want to experience it, you need to buy a new PS4.
Also, the games are range from like $20 to $60 for short experiences at launch.
Yeah, VR games tend to be priced really high
because you're not going to sell in numbers.
I have a PlayStation VR, right? And the only thing that I've touched in the last 2 weeks is Anywhere VR.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, the Resident Evil Biohazard music video got an update. You should probably go look at that.
I probably should. But Anywhere VR was like the highest form of entertainment, like being on a video recorded beach in Japan, just looking in front of me and seeing my tweets that I linked my Twitter account to just floating in the screen in front of me.
Yeah, it's basically, if you remember that weird Wii U panorama view, it's basically that in VR with shit on top of it.
Yeah, except you can see whenever I tweet the Devil's Third box art, so it's infinitely worse.
So it's just, it's actually hell. It's literally Twitter following you wherever you go. It is the actual 2017 version of hell.
I'll be honest, it was free. It was actually kind of relaxing.
But
until somebody tweets the Devil Third box art at you.
Yep.
That's sort of an aside here, the state of the VR industry. I just wonder, the hashtag influencers. I mean, I know, maybe it was Salt and Sanctuary. I can't remember which game it was that ended up on a YouTube channel, like a relatively popular one, and saw a good surge from that.
I mean, Salt and Sanctuary took off because it was part of a PSN. Like, here are the four games we're releasing in 4 weeks. Buy them all, get $10 rebates.
Okay.
Promotion.
So it's things like that. But like, how do you get in front of, you know, non-traditional media who maybe do have voice? How do you pick the ones you target? Like, is there any rhyme or reason to it? Hire someone
who spends every day researching this stuff. If you don't have that money, good luck.
Like, I'm trying to figure out who that would be. Like, I've read, it must not be like the PR companies who email us. Mm-mm. Because they're all.
My other fear, and this is specifically with me, with Monochrono. I don't know how much I want to say on the record about the game, because I haven't done too many formal announcements
it's just speaking about like how you're going to try to get this game out there.
So my fear with this game, one of my biggest fears, so this game has a single-player campaign. It has a challenge mode, it has an arcade mode, it has local multiplayer, and it has some other stuff. That's all what I've announced.
That's your bullet point list.
Some of it, yes. So my fear is, like, what if, like, let's say that a YouTube channel does pick it up, and lo and behold, it's like they're showcasing the local multiplayer or whatever, and they think it's okay, and they sort of recommend it, and then my game is just the local multiplayer game when that is a focus, but there's also like this campaign and all this stuff. So I'm worried that do games need to be cheaper and more streamlined and have one focus, and then I look at these other examples where that is totally not working out, and there does not actually seem to be a rhyme or reason.
Right. I mean, you have something like, not cheaper, you have something like Street Fighter V, where they were very, very tightly focused on what they wanted to do, and it bit them in the ass.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have something like KOF, which came out, a few months ago now?
August.
Which seemed to have no focus whatsoever besides, like, we're going to make another KOF game, and that means we're going to put 75,000 characters in it, and, like, 9 modes, 8 of which are complete horseshit.
Yeah.
Just chaos. Just like, why is this a thing?
Oh, so you've played it.
And it seems to have made them happy because they're making more games now.
Yeah, I really don't know. Like, I have so many fears with releasing Monochrono. But yeah, it's messaging. It's staying on brand, which means a lot of shitty things. But in this case means, like, what do I think is going to be the sales, like the selling point for Monochrono? Is it going to be there's a lot here, and then it's like click the read more on the shop page to find out what's in it, because you've lost half your customer base then.
Yeah.
Half
yeah.
that customer yes, base from, does not from, click read more.
Yeah. From my so point of view, ask... from my point of view, I'm in some regards, I'm sometimes considered an influencer by certain PR people or by people who mm-hmm. contact me about their game. And there was a point when, like, Wii was still vibrant, not so much in the last year or so, but definitely the year before. Even if when the sales weren't good, I would still yes. get like emails from developers and stuff, mm-hmm. and right. they would talk and they would ask from, "Hey, could you, at the very least, could you make a video or a tweet about the game?" And it's like, "Sure, I will check it out." And for me, it's always like, I stopped doing it for a while because A, it was not becoming also really not fun anymore to do. Because it would always feel like I would have to talk about the game, not can.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and to be clear, your videos in general don't have you talking over them.
No, they don't have opinion.
They are gameplay videos. They are cross sections of a piece of gameplay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where you usually, the beginning.
Right, you have the game, you play it for some amount of time based on what the game is.
Then the game crashes if it's on the eShop, and then you quit.
And that's the video. And it's you, a lot of times if it's a Wii U game, it's you starting in the Wii U menu usually.
Yeah.
With the double dons showing up.
Yeah.
And then...
Well, I do that specifically to show the preview screen because that's the first sure. impression you get too.
Yeah, and I that's... That's a nice touch on there, and it's consistent too. So you see it from every game to game. You see how long that opening screen is.
How long yeah. it takes to load, yes.
Oh, I've been definitely, because sometimes I get asked, well, why could you do maybe some commentary? And there's definitely something that I'm not against it. I've done it a couple of times. I definitely want to return to it maybe next year. But it's also, sure. but it's also a thing from, then I really get reeled into your marketing spiel, and I kind of don't want that. Mm-hmm. I want to keep my opinion separately from the videos because that's what my first intention with those videos are, like giving you an impression and seeing if you maybe like it. And then I could always like give my opinion on social media or do something like that. And mm-hmm. even then there are
hashtag
some people,
opinion.
Yeah. Then some people are still like, well, you got this game. Why are you tweeting your opinion about this? It's like, hello. Yeah. That's the point.
Right.
And so for me, the whole thing with the spiel about being like having influence with people and talking about like Nintendo products, it's cool sometimes, but it's also really tiring because you sometimes feel forced to talk about it even if you don't want to.
Yeah.
How many emails, and you don't have to give like specific things, but how many emails do you get from a game where you just look at it and go like, what? Like, like, did you get when the Kotaar games launched their barrage? Did you get emails about that kind of stuff, or is it really that's
done by a PR person at Circle Interactive, which just sends emails from, hey, if you're interested in this, just send me a mail. And usually, okay. Depending on if I'm interested, I will do it yes or no, and sometimes I won't because Circle Interactive releases a lot of games still.
They release a lot of games.
but it's also a surprise because you don't know if it's good or bad because they go... They have no
they
one...
They go everywhere.
They yeah, have because a range. They don't,
yeah, they don't have a pattern like other like developers or publishers I interact with on a daily basis.
Image and Form, probably going to release a good game. Circle, who knows?
Well,
yeah,
with Image and Form,
they don't make their games by and
large. That's actually a good point. Image and Form was the ultimate version of me being an influencer.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Right.
Because nobody was talking about SteamWorld Dig until I did the review, the interview, and the video all in that span of 2 days.
Yes.
And it caused some people to actually went back and actually reviewed like IGN. I heard it from people at IGN because of what I did on NWR and on my YouTube channel. They went back to review that. And I've been...
And in the interim, that game also got more internal coverage from Nintendo. Like Nintendo pushed that game more.
Yeah.
They included it in their indies conversations.
I will be honest, and I've never talked about this. Brian of Image and Form told me that they would get a mention at the end of a Nintendo Direct, and they were really unsure if that would have any impact whatsoever. So I said, okay, I will play your game for 2 hours and see if I like it. If I like it, I will contact you back. Because he seemed, at that point, he had no social media ideas yet. He had no presence yet at that point in time. So I was like, let's do this, because I felt obligated to do also something good sometimes. So I checked it out, really loved it, and I said from, okay, do you, in an hour, do you want to do an interview? And that's how that whole thing came to be. If I'm enjoying myself and see the opportunity there and can help people, then absolutely I will do that. But it's also, at the same time, it needs to come natural, because if I don't like your game, why would I give you a push at all?
Right, because you don't, I mean, there's a certain amount of, and this is where Greg and Greg, I don't want to speak for you, but this is where we kind of have a different perspective, because really we're playing games by and large on our own. You know, these are the games we want to play, and you know, we're not looking at it from the perspective of being, you know, the portal into the industry through which people can learn about games. I mean, if we're talking about a game that is weird or is different or people don't have, we're talking about it, you know, from that perspective. Like, I'm having a lot of fun with this game. It's not so much like, hey, this is a game. It's not part of the reviewer PR cycle in general, mm-hmm. which is a very different experience. And Greg and I have both lived it, and it's a different. There's a different kind of verve to it. Like you're really trying to bring something forward, and you're putting an opinion out there that, you know, a publisher is pushing for the review to come out. You know, they're sending you like a bullet point list of like, hey, here's the things you can look at and talk about in your review. And I'm like, nah.
The funny part is regarding like, for example, Nintendo, they've promoted my review of mine only once in the entire career I've been at NWR, which was with Bravely Default, because they barely had any reviews out there at that point.
That's so what you get for coming out in Europe first.
Yeah. There you go. So I was together there on almost every single page together with official Nintendo magazine, which was weird.
And you're still alive, so, you know, there's that.
Oh.
Well, that was, outlived
also,
them.
When they were doing that, that was not the official Nintendo magazine Americans were expecting when they saw that listing. It's like, no, this isn't the one you get to read. This is the other one.
Yeah.
This is the future media one.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was an interesting time, because I got mails from Nintendo saying, hey, do you want to have a review code? I was like, what? I never had that experience before. So that side of influencer is fun, because you don't expect it to happen.
Do you get reached out to by independent developers or small publishers on a regular basis?
Not so much now, but there was definitely a time where that used to happen more often than you think. And
it would be like, we have this game, would you take a look at it, kind
of
stuff?
Yeah, and like half of the time would turn them down because, A, I played the previous game, it's like, ha, no, whatever. And then the other half is like, okay, I will give it a try and see what happens. And I, these days, I try to tie a review with that now with that e-shopping feature, and before that with like very small, like 300-word reviews.
Yeah, the review minis.
Yeah. But it's, I try to, these days I try to tie more content to it if I do say yes.
Yeah, what I'm not sure about, and Saran, you coming into this, you've got two different, I mean, you also do traditional media. So
yes,
really there's three different perspectives on the, you know, how the internet is pushing, or how conversation about video games mm-hmm. happens from a media standpoint. Don has both the, you know, the text written review, and also has that the YouTube perspective. Mm-hmm. Greg and I very much are podcast focused for the majority of our careers,
mm-hmm.
and then Saran has a lot of print media experience, but also now publicizing a game.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it would be very hard to sort of put a message to thread through to all of those communities, because they're very disjointed and a lot of times they're very fragmented,
mm-hmm.
and. I mean, to a certain extent, there are games that hit zeitgeist.
So I get the honor of, and I do mean honor, of being basically the person in charge of the games that get covered.
Right.
And so, and for those who don't know, we review, oh God, and this is the worst week of the year for this, we review 365 games a year. We review a game on Christmas Day.
What an awful idea.
It keeps people reading. And there's three people. And so obviously we're covering Titanfall, Mario, Call of Duty, Hitman. We're covering Final Fantasy, Kingdom Hearts.
Right. The ones that are big.
Yes. But then, like, for instance, Steam new releases is a treasure trove if you want to exercise those ones and twos. But then also, you have, like, there is just this luxury of having the leeway to say, you know what, no, I'm going to publicize Lady Killer in a Bind. And then getting a bunch of feedback saying, like, I didn't expect to see this here, but I really like it. And so getting the sort of positive reception to being out there and being weird and just being able to cover your beat, as it were.
Yeah. I think people like us, because I'm pretty much my own editor, because I'm the only European editor at NWR.
Right.
I am my own filter.
Well, and on your video stuff, obviously, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I am my own filter. So basically, I have to filter all the stuff and see what works and what is interesting. And I just hit somebody up and say, I'm going to publish this. And they say, okay. And that is my charade. I try to do the best I can filtering that stuff. And that's not all, that's very easy now with the switch between Wii U and Switch. But it's,
yes.
But once Switch gets going again, like those first 2 years will be a whole nother ballpark again.
Especially if you start seeing, you know, stuff get moved over from the independent space in volume, because then filtering out, you know, noise from, like, this needs coverage, but maybe isn't getting it. And let me make a statement here, because the discussion of, you know, as a member of the media, which when Don writes for NWR, he's a member of, you know, a more journalistic side of media than if he's just putting stuff on a YouTube page.
Yeah.
Because we have more rules on that side about, like, you know, what we talk about, and that, because we like to be very professional and very serious, even though none of us get paid. It's like, how do you determine what to take the time on, what to really focus on? And a lot of times it can be hard when, you know, we have had weeks where the review list, it's like there's 12 games on it, or on the list there's 12 games on it, and you couldn't get someone to review 7 of them because they see the name and they go, no, that looks awful. But in some of those, and we've had this happen before, you'll find a game that, like, oh, somebody should have been on that.
Yeah.
Because that game actually had promise and looked interesting.
That's actually how also that eShopping, which you keep mentioning, I should probably explain what that is. That's now a I would say 2 to 3 week schedule feature where I gather a bunch of eShop games and give them a recommendation, yes or no. And you don't know until it's good until you play it, because most of the people, even if it's a good game, are not very good with publicizing that specific video game.
Correct.
For example,
which brings us back to the earlier conversation.
Yeah.
So I had a game called Octocopter, which is basically a weird version of Cuckoo Cuckoo on the Wii U eShop.
Oh.
Which was really fun, actually. And I saw nobody talking about it, and I gave that a solid recommendation in that feature. If I haven't done that, I would have thought about maybe doing a review, and at the end of the day would have likely said no.
But and even before that, like, you had to say, well, I'm going to give this game a chance. And you know, from the two of you, we've heard a lot. But, like, Greg, how do you, like, besides the big games, like, how do you find stuff? I mean, how do you, like, where do you get your information from? Because, I mean, I would say that we are hashtag well-informed consumers.
hashtag ad.
Like, where do you get your information from at this point?
Oh, because it's all from Twitter.
Okay. Great. Those of you who don't know, despite the 12 Greg Leahy Twitter accounts, he's not an active user.
Yes, yeah, exactly. No, I don't get it from that. So, no, I mean, it varies from game to game. You know, I read a lot, basically. You know, I read a lot of, you know, news out of sight to see about games getting announced, and you know, it's just fluke to some extent what like sticks with you. And I mean, goodness knows how many like Circle games have bloody completely you know, passed my notice without. But then I think aren't they they're supposed that they ages ago they were attached to bring in the 3DS Go Go Coca Polo game. I don't know whether anyone remembers the DSiWare game.
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, really, you know,
good,
like,
it was actually a really good game. I wonder what happened to that 3DS game.
So, that yeah, there's a 3DS sequel that was coming, and I think Circle said they were going to publish it one day, and then you just don't hear anything from it. But it's like, I still remember that, even though that game is, you know, could be vaporware for all I know. Like, but then goodness knows how many games just totally, you know, you don't know what you don't know, that old sort of
cliché. Even worse is that the original Coco Polo game is now delisted from the DSiWare.
Yeah, it got taken down. That's right.
Boo. Yeah, I mean, from my standpoint, like, I'm still on all the email lists. I think you got off a lot of the PR lists during your sabbatical.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I still get lots of garbage. And so when I made the comment earlier that all the PR, like, I'm talking about the ones who send you like, They've screwed up capitalization in the subject of their email.
Would this be a good fit for your audience?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hi, James. We think your audience would love this. And it's like the light, smart popcorn popper. And you're like, no, fuck you. I don't care.
Yep. Amen.
But there'll be like a video game in the middle of it because they're doing PR for like six products. And you're like, what? Why? But all that stuff just gets deleted. Because, I mean, I can't. I get so much of it, I can't read it all. And I guarantee you, in the last month, I've deleted PR about a video game that I probably would have liked. Mm-hmm. It's just a consequence of the noise. And as somebody who's on, you know, I'm on the NWR email alias, so I get a lot of stuff from there. I'm on stuff because I've been to E3, I get emails for. Because I was registered at Press at PAX, I get emails for. You know, my name's gotten out there connected to other stuff. And so I just get noise. So that's a dead channel to me. I get a lot of stuff in it, but effectively it's
noise on my personal email, noise on the NWR email, and noise on the Go Nintendo Tips email, which I also maintain.
Yeah, I mean, it becomes effectively just not a useful tool at that point.
Yeah.
No.
Because it's effectively the boy who cried wolf as supported by an email direct marketing machine. So how do you get out there? So for me, it's like, okay, what do I see, as Greg pointed out, on Twitter for people who are following? What do I see? Like, there are people who I have sort of gauged, I have an affinity for what they like.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is just what I see covered on, like, there's a handful of YouTube channels that I'll go watch because they cover games that I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it's just dumb random chance. I find something on the Wii U eShop. A lot of times it's because I have to have something for this show.
So,
and I just go through the eShop and go like, what the fuck is in here?
So similar to the pressure to have something for the show, the real reason, I guess, you know, peek behind the curtain, one of the real reasons that we do the review every day is it forces us to explore more. And for instance...
Which is why I asked, what the fuck were you thinking?
Yeah, for instance... Kindred Spirits on the Roof, my number two game of the year, would never have heard of it.
Well, yeah, because it would have been just another anime game on Steam.
It wasn't on Steam initially. It wasn't even there.
Oh, God. Yeah, all right, well...
It was just trying to... Like, I have to look through all the noise, and I open it, and I skim, and I move on, and I sort into folders... And it's just a lot of taking chances, and a lot of times, boy, does that lower end of the review score spectrum get used. But
well,
then,
go ahead, and then we'll go transition. Yeah. We'll do a quick email or two.
Yeah, but then the other one, you know, the other times you find something really special that no one else is talking about.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The emails I get that are like. Legitimately, personally to me, saying, we think you will like this game, or like, I follow you on Twitter and I'm making this game and think it is up your alley because this, 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 and this, or like, I have gotten two separate review copies from games because they heard me talking about games on RFN for whatever reason. They're just like, you know, We know you like this about this game, this about this game. We think our game, you know, is something that you will actually like. Do you want to take a look at it?
You could email us, guys. I mean, we talk about games on here too, you know.
I think they were both Nintendo.
I think the personalized email goes a long way to...
It does.
...to let you check out a game. Especially considering I am... Like, I talk to certain developers a lot. They will send me from, hey, we think you would really like this, and then I'll actually check it out. It's, for me, it's really depending on the email they write, how they mentioned it, and just filtering out the bad stuff.
Yeah, I mean, when I get an email from a listener, actually, it's one of the most, like, oh, I should probably pay attention to this. Because, you know, I joke that I've made this joke before, that the people who listen to the show probably know what I like better than I do. Because it's really hard to spot trends in the games you're playing versus games another person.
Oh no, I definitely see that. I used to be on a weekly podcast. There was a Seren remembers the Weeds podcast.
Not Weeds, Weeds.
Yeah, which was a UK podcast, but I was on there weekly, which was really fun. And people would send me like emails giving me recommendations because I wasn't that much in the industry back then. And yeah, I would get
this
some
was like 2009 to 2010?
Yeah, something like that. No, I think 2008, 2009. And people would give me like really solid recommendations of what to play.
Yeah, it's always interesting when you get a recommendation from somebody who's listened to you, because a lot of times they're pretty spot on.
Yeah, for sure.
And you know, that's always really cool, and I really enjoy that. But I did want to get to some email really fast. We've kind of gone long, and I've got one that's super relevant. We'll see how we're doing on time. So email, you can send them to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. You can send us your recommended games also. Oh, I'm sorry. You wanted to talk about Ivan, but we've got to move
just
on.
Just make it a chapter art or something. I'll do.
Yeah. So Seren played Devil's Third on YouTube. I got
you can make it
on
all
the
chat
because
isn't there more than one box art for the different regions? Like have
no,
it changed.
There are two box art.
Change
one of them
from
is the
one
meme.
To the other and then back again. Fine.
Don got sad and I got drunk and angry. That was that Devil's Third stream. You can find it on YouTube.
Yeah,
I say some things I'm not proud
Search
of.
Search on YouTube for Seren McNulty plays Devil's Third. It's about 6 hours, but YouTube will remember where you left off.
Gosh.
There are some real revelations that, specifically from James, over the course of that.
Well, because I was drunk, okay?
I can't even remember what I said on that live stream.
Because you wanted to die.
You wanted to die.
Because I went to bed at like, is it 6:30 after
it
that
was,
stream?
It was basically 7 in the morning.
My
yeah.
favorite thing is that the thought never occurred to James that he could just leave. He was welcome to. He was allowed to leave. The thought never occurred to him, so he stuck
That's
the whole
That's not true, because
hours.
I got out of the call and was immediately called back.
No, you were dropped from the call.
I'll take any route
I,
out
yeah,
I
dropped.
Get.
I dropped James like solid 5 times from the call.
And it just kept coming back. Anyway, that was a nightmare. Lomanade writes, Dear RFNWR chat, on a scale of 1 to 10, I'd personally expect a lot of game review scores to fall more towards the median range, 4 to 6. That said, it appears most game reviewers give final scores at 7 or above. Even NWR over the last year has given a score of 7 or higher to 77% of all reviews posted thus far in 2016. What gives? Are games better now? Is it the result of game publishers pressuring news outlets? Or news outlets being compelled to give better review scores due to well-known incentives tied to Metacritic reviews? Or is it something much more obvious?
The obvious answer is because with limited staff, especially on NWR, who doesn't get paid, people are more likely to review games that look good or that they're interested in playing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah like I would say, I mean, I didn't have that much experience reviewing games. I wasn't very good at it. But, I mean, there was...
Disagree,
you,
but all
you
right.
You could break the games I reviewed down into two categories. There were ones that I was assigned to do. But,
Spider-Man Chronicles, which
usually was stuff that basically no one else could do, because a lot of the time it would involve shipping the game.
It was mailed out of London.
But in some cases it was games that would have to be shipped overseas, which was one of the significant costs of the site.
It's not really anything that anybody wanted to do.
They probably didn't want me to do it, but I could do it, and I've only got so much bandwidth. So there was those games, and then there was games that, you know, like might be import games or something like that, where I would have a chance to play early because it's something I was interested in, like Saran just said. Mm-hmm. You could see the difference in the scores, basically. I mean, it's surprisingly enough, is that simple. You know, where the games that I was assigned, and this is during 2008. Kind of, which is Apex, like DS and Wii. Mm. You know, I reviewed stuff like Hurry Up Hedgehog and Doodle Hex and
Garbage.
Yeah. Pirates and all this stuff that, you know, I never would have sought out myself. And like, there were, I look back at it, there's like, there's a 3 in there, there's a 4 in there, there's a 5, a 6, a 6, a 6. Yeah, there's a lot of the medium to sub media, sort of scores that Lomane's looking for. Then if you look at the games that I put, and some upper ones that I liked more than I might have expected, like the Pinball Hall of Fame game that I reviewed and stuff like that. But then there's the stuff I sought out, because it was something I was already interested in, and I'd played the game before the rest of the staff, so I could review it. You're talking about Sin and Punishment 2, mm-hmm. and Tatsunoko versus Capcom, mm-hmm. and guess what? Those scores skewed higher. Now, so just extrapolating from my own experience, with the kind of collapse in the market that Nintendo's had since I was reviewing games, you're going to get a lot fewer of those games that I was assigned to review, for the site to cover, basically. I mean, I know, obviously, Don shows us that there are very many delights on the eShop.
Actually, Wes is a good point. At the back end of 2015, I sort of made a call that I kind of want to filter the stuff that comes on the NWR.
And
I realized that it wasn't worth, like, in the grand scheme of things, reviewing games that are very low scored or have no purpose being reviewed, because honestly nobody would check them out.
It's worth it for me.
But we're not serving an audience of one here. Like, somebody has to edit this review too.
I'll edit and read it.
Okay, we'll talk about it after the show.
I'll put you in touch with Neil.
Yes. But there will be some times where I will review like a 3 out of 10 or 5 out of 10 game because I think it's funny, or I can make the review interesting, or I will have an off day, or there's nothing else really coming out. But other than that, if there is more pressing stuff to talk about, honestly, I don't really feel the need to write a review about a really low score game, because again, it serves only the purpose of, just shouldn't buy this, because people can already see that in the review score list and say 3 out of 10. You know what? I'm not gonna play this game. I'm good.
So there is a filter that we go through before we even consider reviewing it, and it is literally this: is this game a scam? And I mean this more on Steam.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Do the Steam reviews
criticize that they forgot to include the executable?
Which has happened more than you would expect.
That has happened. That has stopped me 3 times.
Oh, God.
Like, the first thing is this literally a scam? Is it Unit Z? Basically, like, is it just an asset flip? And if it passes my very basic test, my recommendation for listeners, if you're concerned about this, you're interested in looking at it, just about every site I know, somewhere on it, usually linked to all the reviews, you can, like, our review score policy. And you can click it and see what their scale represents. So, for instance, Game Informer, a 7 is average for them. Mm-hmm. So they rate it like a school like a high school assignment.
Right. As things start to trend down beyond, like, this is reaching out of acceptable range. Yeah. That's when you start dropping past your sixes.
Yes. And at that point, it's like, what's the difference between a 3 and a 4?
Yeah.
If a 5 is a low F, what's the difference between a 3 or 4 on that scale? And my criticisms of the Game Informer scale aside, then you have sites like Giant Bomb, who just sort of gut check, just 5 stars, nothing in between. It's bad, it's mediocre, it's okay, it's good, it's great.
And to them, we have a very similar situation here where it's very personal.
Mm-hmm.
We and having so many reviewers, not having centralized locations, you know, not having a standard review editor, it's hard for us to set a standard like that because yeah. everybody's going to come at it differently.
Yes.
So basically, the reviews editor job at NWR is read the review, look at the score, and do they seem congruent?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of there's a lot of leeway there, but I mean, I've definitely reviewed a review, as
yes.
it were. Edited a review and looked at the score and looked at the text and gone, these don't seem compatible. Like mm-hmm. there seems to be a pretty stark contrast.
We do
here.
That.
I go back to the review and go, what happened?
Yeah, we write the review and then we pitch the score to the rest of the team.
Right.
And usually it's within 0.5. We're out of 10 with 0.5s. And usually it's within 0.5 of where the reviewer thought. There was a point, this was specifically with Mario Party 10, mm-hmm. where the review, this was not my review, I was not gonna fucking take that game, the text was just all criticism and how they had a bad time, and then they gave it a 6. Mm-hmm. And we had a talk,
right.
because that was not congruent, and it ended up being a 3. Because... Our,
right. You're not having a good time.
Yes, our scale is a 5, and James disagrees with me on this, but our scale is a 5 is the average quality of the experience in that genre. If you release a functional, bland first-person shooter that has competent online but it's really nothing special, that's a 5.
Actually, I totally agree with that. I follow yes. that scale too.
Yes. If your game is Devil's Third, you get a 2.5 out of 10. But if, like, that means that 9s, we have extra meetings on anything higher than a 9, 9.5 and 10, and anything lower than a 2.
Mm-hmm. So I will say that NWR does have a guide. I don't know that it's published anywhere, but I'm looking at it right now. It is published? Okay. So for us, like, a 0 is basically just like, it does not fucking work. Like, or has, to use the quote, has no redeeming qualities worth mentioning. Like, achieving a 0 is actually an accomplishment. Like, if you release a game that can boot and still manage to earn a 0, you have done something magical.
Like
you literally made a game that has nothing positive to say about it. Like that's really truly an accomplishment. So for us, a 5, which we really only define 0, 5, and 10.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a 10 is not perfect. A 10 is like there's no detractors really worth mentioning, or that
it's
there
the
there
inverse.
Could be problems. Right. I've definitely had 10 conversations when John was my reviews editor. For example, we had conversations about.
Galaxy 2
we had a 10 conversation on, and on Takumi's other game,
Ghost
I'm blanking
Trek.
On it now. Yeah. And in the end I came up with flaws for both and knocked them both down to 9.5s.
Mm-hmm.
Which is actually 2 drops because we do quarter system. But for us, a 5 is like the good and the bad are more or less balanced. And you might still recommend a 5, but it's going to be a really niche scenario where you recommend a 5. You're going to say, like, hey, to these very small band of people, this 5 might be worth experiencing. So a game that I think plays like garbage, Fragile Dreams, does not get a 5 because I don't think it's balanced. I think the absolute garbage gameplay is totally accompanied or totally taken care of, and in fact, more than exceeded by the ambiance, the mise-en-scene, the storytelling,
mm-hmm.
the getting emotionally invested in that game. So I actually rated that game really high, like a 7 or an 8, because I was deeply invested in what that game was, even though I think its gameplay is horseshit terrible.
Yeah, okay.
So if I were to say, though, rate it on the average of the genre, I would have to knock that game way down, because a lot of games in that genre have mise-en-scène and have, you know, environmental storytelling and have experiences. But the way it did it was so different that it impacted me more heavily.
And a good example for me personally is that people thought I rated Mario Tennis Ultra Smash 2 too heavily. Like, I gave it a score of 3.5, which I still fully stand behind.
It could have been a 3. I stand by my suggestion that it could have just been a 3.
Okay. Can I please make my point? Yeah.
Yes, yes, please.
The thing is, I would still thought that game was way below average. There was still a lot of stuff missing. I felt that how the gameplay was presented was below like standard effort. So I gave it.
It was a very light game.
Yeah. So I gave it the score that I thought thought appropriate, because it was not on an average level and it was way more bad than good. And I saw a lot of fives, I saw even a few sixes, and a lot of people complained to me from, you know, you should have given that game a 5 because it definitely deserves not that. And honestly, in my world, it still deserves that low score because that game has accomplished nothing. It's not broken, right, but it has accomplished nothing.
So, I mean, to use our metric, so the good is it looks nice, and I guess the controls were okay, but the bads are, what do you do in this game? Like, I mean, somebody once described this game to me as the demo of a full game.
Yeah, and also, why does your online doesn't even have a friend option in 2015?
When your Wii U has friends built into it?
Yeah.
In your first party game?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, there's no way that the goods and the bads balance each other out in this game.
But also, I mean, I think people's, like, when you talk about scores and text being congruent, I think that's, you know, that's a fair thing to expect. And, you know, it's probably healthy that it goes through that kind of editorial process to, you know, try and get them to match up and, you know, have some kind of consistency there. But at the same time, you know, I do think there's too much fixation on the numbers. You know, the text is really what you want to read, because, you know, if you do want to get a deeper sense of whether this game is something you would enjoy, is worth spending your money on, then, you know, there may be certain, you know, downsides to a game that, you know, you can tell from the text matter more to the reviewer, or, you know, the reviewer thinks matter more to the average consumer than they would to you, you know, and so, you know, that score is one thing, but how it relates to your preferences and your, you know, sort of play styles or whatever else, you know, is another thing. So, I mean, I don't think it's, you know, like,
absolutely,
pointless or anything,
yeah,
to try and, like, act like the scores mean something, because they do mean something, but they also feel like people just invest too much in them, and it's way out of proportion with the actual sentiment, the actual critique and evaluation that's
in
the text.
Yeah, to be fair, the text, I always write my text first before I even think of a score. My score is most of the time, it is an afterthought. And when somebody looks it over, be it Brian, who was our reviews editor, or anybody else, I had never had a conversation about, I think this score is wrong, because every single time I try to look at the text one more time and think, which score do I think is most appropriate to that text?
Right. There are scenarios where I've had a game where, like, I just know the number. Like, it's just, oh, I know what this is.
It's a lot of times a gut feeling, you know.
Yeah, like, oh, this game is 7 as hell. I know 7's the poison number, but there are games where it's like... Some games just feel like a 7. You're like, okay, this game's good, outweighs its bad, but it's not doing anything special.
Yeah, well, I guess, with the numbers, well, I would say, you go back to Lolmanate's question, yeah, maybe with certain outlets, or I wouldn't say this of our site, whatever, you know, maybe there could be a leniency bias thing happening where,
sure,
you know, people just generally don't want a score on the lower end of the scale. Yeah, I mean, he talks about specific reasons like, you know, Metacritic incentives, the built into the industry now and all that. But, you know, it's just kind of a human impulse, you know, leniency bias to some extent. So there's that. But like I said, you know, I think if the text is well written, you know, that isn't really a problem because, you know, you can look past the number and actually get a better sense of the recommendation. But to go back to, I think Seren's first point was the most salient in actually answering Lolmanator's question. It's more of an issue of selection bias than it is of leniency bias.
Absolutely. So
the things we cover at NWR and a lot of places are going to skew more to what we think the audience is interested in, what we personally are interested in, you know, especially as a volunteer site. And so, you know, especially in a lean period like this, where, you know, the amount of stuff coming out is not like deluges of stuff that people are sending review copies and we feel obligated to forward them on and all that, it is going to skew higher. It doesn't necessarily
it's
mean
not
the output of... Yeah, so it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, games have got better in general or anything like that, but certainly, you know, the average quality of a game that is being reviewed by us probably has gone up. Like, that is actually true.
Zach just gave a 2 to a third-party published game with retail release in Cartoon Network Battle Crashers. It does happen.
If you are looking for where the bad games are, might I recommend Steam?
Yeah.
I would recommend... The dark web.
I would actually say there's some truth to that, though, because as much as we talked about, you know, the score mattering and the text mattering too, there's a certain amount of, like, there's so many outlets that sometimes the score becomes shorthand, much like we only pick the games that we're really interested in.
Let's be honest. Do people really want to review by those Thornberry software games?
No. Yeah. I mean, the thing is that there's... Steam is an interesting point here because a lot of the crapware, like the stuff that, A, isn't profitable to make anymore. Like, it isn't profitable to make your DS Storytime Adventures port of a Wii game that wasn't
mouth.
A game. Like, there's no money in that anymore. But more pressingly, like, those games may have gone, if they still get made, may have gone to mobile. They may have gone to Steam. And while they're still fucking atrocious, they're outside of our review purview. And because they're not on a disc on a shelf, most outlets are probably never going to touch it. When we used to get sent physical ass review copies of games and like things would just show up and like, oh, here's a package. It was overnighted from, you know, New Jersey. It's got Speed Racer, the movie, the game DS, and Speed Racer, the movie, the game Wii in it. Well, somebody had to review those games because we're holding a physical copy in our PO box and somebody needs to get rid of it. It turns out Speed Racer, the movie, the game is actually pretty good. But when, you know, when it's just like, hey, I can put this on Steam and I don't need to really worry about retail sales. I just need to get X number of sales to cover my costs and I'm good. The impetus to do the PR push isn't high because they know their game's going to review like crap. And the costs are so low that they don't have to necessarily push anyone to review it. And we don't have a physical copy sitting on somebody's desk they need to get rid of.
Mm-hmm.
So the selection bias isn't just us saying we're not interested in this game. It's that, A, these games may not be in our area of coverage anymore. And B, even if they are, they're in the, you know, they're in the also released on the eShop this week.
Mm-hmm.
Like, nobody's pushing us to review them because everybody knows what they are. Like, we're not getting emails about the Kokoto Platform Jumper release.
Aww.
We just aren't. I mean, because they know we're not going to give it a great review, and we know we're not going to give it a great review, and the barrier for entry for that game was so low, they're not worried about us. They're just worried about the game selling enough copies to get through their expenses.
Yeah.
And so self-selection by the publishers is also, like, they're selecting
their
platform.
Expectations, they're baked in the cake, you know. The distribution model is just totally different, you know, from when I was doing reviews, even on Nintendo platforms, which, of course, have been sort of lagging in general.
Hedgehog is not getting made for the 3DS. It just isn't.
It certainly isn't.
Damn, thank fucking God.
You know, and I mean, in some ways, you know, there's, you know, the eShop has kind of, like you said, has opened it up, you know, a lot more to like loads of small games. But on the other hand, you've got all the stuff that, you know, kind of dominate. Like, yeah, I mean, GBA was before my time, but you think of all those licensed games that, that people had to review in the GBA era that, you know, obviously just don't exist in boxes for anything now.
THQ, right.
They're just they're just on mobile or whatever else, you know.
And I would say that I had two run-ins with those games, really. I had a review of Disney, I can't remember what it was called, like Disney Friends, I think, which is a DS game. Mm-hmm. Just a virtual pet with Disney characters that was shockingly good and competent, and it got the nasty 7 score because, like, this is... There's more than good. There's more good here, even though the game itself is kind of bland to play. It's got a ton of character. And then there was a Minions DS game that I had a run-in with. That was it wasn't Lost Vikings. It was Lemmings with minions wrapped on it.
Good.
And like it was trash garbage at E3. And then they're like, "Hey, do you want to review this?" And I'm like, "No, no, I don't," because I made the mistake of giving them a business card. I'm like, "No, thank you. If you could send our review requests to," and I gave them our PR email address. And we never reviewed that game, I think, because Invisible Me DS, being a Lemmings clone, was not enticing. But now, like, yeah, that game is on mobile, so we don't see it. If it even exists, it may not even exist. Like, they're not necessarily making mobilized ports because the competition space on mobile and Steam is gross.
I mean, as Fred said,
60% of the games on Steam 40. Came out this year. 40. Came out this year. Like, that's insane. And what are the odds your shitty remake of Lost Vikings starring the characters from Finding Dory are going to make any money? Probably not high.
Well, sometimes those games still disappear on 3DS, but in very small quantities.
Yeah, much, much less common than they used to be.
Because,
I mean, it used to be like PG-13 and R, and sometimes even R-rated games were getting like GBA ports, and you're like, why? Like, why are you making this like...
Terminator toys.
Why are you... Yeah, RoboCop why are you toys. Making... Yeah. Why are you making like a RoboCop GBA game in 2003? Like, A, there hasn't been a RoboCop movie in almost 2 decades, and B, why? Like, what are you doing? But those games happened because there was still money to be made there, I guess. But now it's not that games have gotten better, to answer this last part of his question. It's that games that we see have not gotten – or have – the games that we see aren't as bad. We don't see games where Jeff Shirley will say that it's only pro is that if you can put a bullet through the middle of it, you're a really good shot. Like those games happened before. They don't happen now. Not to us.
I will never review a game like Flappin' Together ever again.
Are you sure, Don? They've released correction. 2 other games on PS4.
All right. I think that's going to have to do it for us this week because we were aiming for an hour and we're well over that.
Or Tessens so with Robots?
We've got some plugs to handle. Don, you've got a podcast.
I have a podcast. Thank you very much for mentioning that. So I started a new podcast called Coffee Talk. You can find the first episode on SoundCloud. That is soundcloud.com/ Dan's Coffee Talk. That's all one word.
We'll have a link in the article.
Yeah, and the first episode is with Brian of Image and Form. We talk 2 hours about life, gaming, and everything in between. I hope to make future episodes a bit shorter than this because the first episode was over 2 hours long.
We've said that before.
Yeah, so so the next episode will hopefully be around an hour and 10 minutes, maybe something like that. Still trying to figure out a guest for the second episode. Still trying to see what I want to do with the next episode because I want to make a more structure into it. The first one was a bit more, let's shoot the shit and see where it goes.
So your goal for this show,
mm-hmm.
give me like 2 sentences.
Sure. It's answering questions and having a freeform conversation from start to finish. So nothing is scripted. And we'll just see where it goes.
And your target is obviously game developers, but are you?
Oh no, not just game developers. Anybody who has like a solid amount of stuff to talk to regarding games, regarding anything we talk to in that hour.
Okay, so it could in theory be somebody else who also does what we do.
Yeah, it could technically be you in the next episode. Who knows?
Well, it'll be better than talking about Devil's Third.
Nothing is better than talking about
Devil's Third. I've already tweeted the box out while we were recording.
Of course you have. All right, Don. Where else can we find your content? We're just going to ignore that she's here for the rest of the show.
Yeah, let's ignore this. You can find me on YouTube, which is at Nintendan. It's Nintendan, and then a 1 at the end. You can do the same with just without the 1, so Nintendan is on Twitter. I'm next to Nintendo World Report, I'm on NF Magazine, Go Nintendo, and a whole bunch of other places.
Everywhere.
Yeah, but most of the writing stuff happens here on NWR.
Saran, I'm afraid. What do you have to plug?
She's going to plug the Devil's Sword box art again.
I have the editing power here. It can go away.
Let me see here. We've already plugged that stream. Let me see.
We have.
Stream, Santa. Yeah, appropriate.
That. Yeah.
I think it will never flow again, hopefully.
We're all good on that.
There was a phrase I said to somebody who messaged me out of the blue during that, and all I responded with was, "What am I doing? F*** everything." And she's like, "Okay, I'll talk to you later."
And you can actually buy a copy here in Europe.
I did not bring this
euros.
Conversation up.
All right, moving on. Yeah, so I was about to cut this anyway.
Is stay tuned in January. You will hear much more about some of the stuff I've been working on. That's all I can say contractually.
Fair enough.
But you'll hear and you'll see some cool shit. Some of it you might not have to tune in specifically for. So you might just see some.
Would
of
you
it.
Wake up staring
know.
At you in the face?
Depends on what you're doing in January.
Hi.
Hell no.
I've got some cool shit
Ivan.
For you.
Monocrono is. Yeah, Monocrono's doing
I know. Every
well.
Time you're on the show, I ask you when it's coming out. Is there an answer this time?
27.
Okay.
2017. You can.
The answer, it's the new Frog Fractions 2.
Frog Fractions 2 came out before Monocrono. And I'm
came out and was found.
How long this game is taking. Yes. Frog Fractions, the jig became up. Possibly up to a year before Monocrono came out. This is really disheartening. Monocrono stuff in January. If you follow me on Twitter, you'll see a lot of it. I'm not going to plug my personal Twitter this time. I'm going to plug my company Twitter. You can follow at Four Corner Games. That's the numeral 4, all one word. And if you just want to follow update about the game and Monocrono Prologue, you can follow at Monocrono on Twitter, and if you prefer to get your news in the Japanese language, you can follow at Monocrono JP.
If you're a listener to this English language podcast, you really want their Japanese news.
I mean, that's a better thing to plug on the Famicast, I admit, but at Monocrono JP does exist because for actual reasons. It's not just I got bored and decided to create a Japanese promotional account, but
fair enough. All right. So I've already plugged the email address. It's rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. You know where you can find Greg and I. It's here, for better or worse. And I'm not going to say what today was. So
I have one last question for you before we sign off.
Oh, boy.
Is this 503? And if so, return of 103?
400 episodes later.
I didn't even think about that! God damn it! Greg, what's our end music this week?
Actually, you know, I really struggle with end music. It is going to be the final episode of that we record during this year. A year which began, I think an early episode of the year, began with me playing the vocal arrangement of Pollyanna from the original Mother, which includes lyrics like I believe in all sorts of lovely things. didn't really quite work out. I don't think that's not that
year.
Prophetic for 2016. Turns out, but so it's got, so you know, you got, what do you put a bow on with this? So I wanted something that was kind of somber, had a kind of finality to it, but you know, also. Makes me sort of happy to listen to, you know, with good memories and whatnot. So I think we're going to go with the staff roll from Super Castlevania 4, which is surprisingly sort of melancholy, considering you've just killed Dracula. But yeah, it's one of my favourite end credits music, and I think it's a nice way to put a cap on this year, however it went for you personally, dear
it
listener.
It didn't if you watched my stream.
But
all right, well, on that, it's time to end the show. I want to thank Don and Seren for joining us today. I think.
Thank you.
Haven't decided
guys,
yet.
Guys, happy
New
Year,
everybody. Let's hope 2017 will have at least 20 more RFN episodes before this whole thing goes off the rails for good. We'll see. And on that, bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.